Hello everyone, welcome to the Fast Pod, your fortnightly update on all things motorsport. I'm Graham Cleland and I'm here as usual with my co-host John Doran. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Another busy weekend. In fact, you'd have to say it was the glamour weekend in motorsport with the Monaco Grand Prix and Indy 500 both on at the same weekend, so plenty to watch.
Yeah, there was lots going on. There was certainly lots of different angles on both. What did you make of each of them?
I thought the Monaco was Monaco. I mean, it's a special event. I liked all the new camera shots that they brought in this year, but you find yourself looking at it and going, it's the Monaco Grand Prix, and yet all everybody was talking about was two qualifying laps. Now, admittedly, the two laps from Max Verstappen and Fernando Alonso were simply stunning, but surely there should be more to F1 racing than two qualifying laps.
You know, I thought what Verstappen did was astonishing, actually, given that he was slightly behind when he started that lap. And yeah, the qualifying was great, and there was lots of coverage of that. And I liked all the razzmatazz around Monaco. You know, you've got to say, it's a brilliant event. And my overriding impression, really, I guess, of that event, and maybe Formula 1 in general at the moment, is that they're getting a lot of things right off the track. You know, they've reinvigorated its sort of mass appeal, and, you know, the Netflix Drive to Survive effect has helped that. So nobody's struggling for sponsors or media coverage. And, you know, Martin Brundle's doing his stuff maybe better than ever on the grid beforehand. So it's a phenomenal event, but the race was dull. You know, and unfortunately...
Until it rained.
until it rained, and that spiced it up a little bit, which saved it. But I guess there's still a bit of me thinks that that's happening too often in too many events. Yeah. And I don't think the regs are quite there yet in terms of, you know, making really compelling racing. Is that fair?
Well, I think that's fair. And I think it works particularly when you compare it with the Indy 500, because I think they've got the racing part of it bang on, but probably haven't got the marketing side of it. So I think sometimes the packaging there could be slightly better. But whether you agree with the fact that they had three red flags in the last 16 laps or whatever, and a last lap shootout, is that the way to sort a really big race? Fair play to New Garden for winning. But again, you find yourself looking at the main talking point, which was the Kyle Kirkwood crash. I mean, thank God that they all came out of that. Nobody was hurt. But when you see a tyre not only going into over the crowd, and landing in the car park, and apparently the woman's car, she'd named her car Snowball, but it was pretty heavily damaged, and you can only think you're just glad that tyre didn't hit somebody in the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely, John. You know, we all know motorsport's dangerous, and we've talked about that on previous shows and things like that before. But really, for a premier event like that as well, you know, you want to be talking about the great stuff that happens on track after it, you know, the racing, yeah, etc., and not safety issues like that. And that was a bit of a shocker.
Speaking of which, you were slightly closer to home, I think.
Yeah, down at the Jim Clark Rally.
That's a great rally.
Yeah, it's a brilliant rally and a really high quality field. So lots of people want to come and drive it because of the unique nature of the closed roads. Surfaces down there in Duns, and it's just a bit special. You know, it's got a lot of history, but really impressive performance by M Sports Adrian Fermo. You know, now he's got lots of WRC experience. He should be fast, but I was down there on Friday doing some media stuff and the build-up, and the interesting bit of chatter in the service part was, would he really be quicker than guys like Cronin and Pearson, etc., on a rally like that? But he certainly showed his class and his quality, and he you know, scorched the opening couple of stages on Friday night and never really looked back. And it's not like he had a huge advantage in terms of machinery or anything like that. So he just showed that he's got a touch of class and that actually he's got the talent to definitely be competing at WRC level.
Yeah, definitely one to be looking out for.
Yeah, it was great. And the sun shone, so that always makes things look better. So yeah, a lot of fun, and it's nice to do an event like that, which isn't too far from home for a change.
See, we do have good days in Scotland.
Occasionally.
Sun does shine.
Occasionally.
The focus now is turning towards Le Mans. That is always an epic event. You talk about Monaco, you talk about the Indy 500. Le Mans is right up there as a massive event.
I think even people who don't pay that much attention to enduring racing, you know, the rest of the year round, still definitely, you know, keep one eye on Le Mans. You know, people from all sorts of categories of motorsport want to go and compete there. You know, it's got that luster, and you can see that, you know, with guys coming from F1 and from IndyCar in the past, and, you know, everybody wants a slice of it. And the grid's always oversubscribed, isn't it? So, and in terms of crowd, it's massive. What, there'll be 300,000 people there probably over the course of this weekend, easily. You know, so it is just one of those great events. And yeah, it's really exciting this year because of the regulation changes. You've got more manufacturers coming in the top category, so it looks like it's going to be much more competitive than in the last couple of years, when, let's be honest, the field depth at the top end hasn't been as good as it has been further down. So yeah, it seems to be all teed up to be a pretty good one, doesn't it?
And it's an anniversary one. Anniversary ones are always really good. I remember doing the 50th Rolex at Daytona, and it was all, like, everything cranked up a level just because it was a special anniversary.
Le Mans always got a lot of promotion behind it, but it's already, you know, you've seen a lot of it over the past couple of months building up to the hundreds. So yeah, I think it's shaping up nicely.
I thought it'd be a really good idea to get somebody that's really on the inside for Le Mans. Jeff Carter, European Le Mans Series press officer, the Le Mans 24-hour photo delegate, a photographer and a videographer. So we thought we'd get him on and have a chat about all things Le Mans.
Great stuff. Let's get him on.
Welcome, Jeff. We're approaching Le Mans, the 100th year, but it's all a bit of a buzz, isn't it?
It's a huge buzz. It really is. 100 years, 1923 was the first race. It's the 90th edition. So it's obviously we missed a few during the war. I didn't. Obviously, I wasn't old enough. There are a few missing in the 100 years, but obviously 1923 was the first race, and 300,000 tickets have been sold for this year's race. So it's going to be an amazing atmosphere. It will be my 13th Le Mans, 12th as part of the organisation, and I did 2010 with a certain Nigel Mansell. I was his team press officer when he did the 17 minutes of Le Mans, because he crashed at Indianapolis not long after the start, unfortunately. So my first Le Mans was a bit of a short-lived one, but 2012 onwards I became part of the organisation.
So I mean, that must have been a real media buzz when Mansell was doing it. I mean, that was a sort of a really big event, wasn't it?
It was. Obviously, Nigel, being Nigel, being a very much a people person, we had people coming down dressed up in flat caps and moustaches, and he was well in for all that. He was racing with his two sons, Leo and Greg, so it was a family affair. Andrew Howard of Beach Dean Ice Cream was team manager, and it was a great, fantastic atmosphere. I think I don't think Nigel will mind me saying, it was a bit of a culture shock for him, because obviously he's used to driving around with other drivers, not in groups of drivers and sharing the drive so much than he had before. He actually said to me that he was going down the Mulsanne Strait in an LMP1 car, coming up behind GTE cars at 50, 60 mile an hour difference in closing speed. And he didn't know which way the driver was going to go, because he didn't know who was in that car. He said, if it was a Formula One car, I'd know exactly who was in that car and how he would react. And I think that's the difference with Le Mans, you've got drivers of all different abilities. And I think that's what makes it special.
And I suppose dealing with him and the interest in him, I mean, made it easier for when you were sort of handling the media for the event. I mean, what is it like in the media room? And what sort of things do you have to deal with?
Well, that one was obviously different because I was a team press officer, whereas I'm usually, since 2012, I've been sort of running the media office alongside the ACO. So I've got 600 plus journalists, photographers, and another 600 TV crews on the TV compound, who I also have to look after with regards to safety. So it's a massive, massive, biggest event I've ever been involved with. Normally at a WC meeting, it would be 500 maximum. An ELMS meeting, you're talking 150. So it's a huge logistical thing. I'm glad that it's not my responsibility, it's the ACO responsibility to look after the media, but I'm there to help from a point of view of the photography side, and up to 2021, obviously, from the FIA side.
I was just going to say, certainly one of the highlights when I've been at races was hearing you do your photographer briefing. And it's almost like herding cats. So, I mean, how do you deal with that and getting people to do the right things and not put themselves in danger?
Right. I'll tell you how it all came about. You know, my background is I was an engineer in the Royal Air Force. I left in 1996. I became a photographer. My two hobbies were motorsport and photography. And I sort of drifted into the writing side slash media delegate, media press officer side. So I go out there. I still go out and photograph. So the guys see me out there photographing. So they respect what I tell them because I'm a guy who does the job myself. It all came about because in 2011, we used to do written briefings. So basically, we would give them at the beginning of the meeting, you'd send all the media information out, and we'd give all the photographers send the do's and don'ts. But there was no actual check to whether they read it or not. Anyway, we were at Zolder with the GT1 World Championship, and a photographer put himself in a really bad position and he got himself killed. I pulled him in and said, "What the hell were you doing there?" And he said, "Oh, I thought it was a good place, but nobody else was there. And there was a good reason nobody else was there, because it's actually a red zone." So I said to him, "Did you actually read the briefing?" And he went, "Oh, no." And that for me was like a light bulb moment, thinking, yeah, I need to do these in person in front of people and make sure they understand. It's a bit like getting on a plane. You know, they all stand there doing the safety brief on the planes. Not many people listen to it, but at least we can say we've done it. And they had to listen to it. So that started in 2011. I brought it across the World Endurance Championship when I started in 2012 there. And in 2020, we moved to video for obvious reasons because of COVID. And we've continued to use the video. Now, how we check to see that they're actually watching the video, we have a little code word that flashes up on the screen very briefly, and they have to write the code word down. That can appear anywhere in the video. So we do check that they're actually watching it. And most, I would say 99.9% of the people do actually watch it and understand the briefing. But I do have a rogues gallery and I do use them. So I do say to people, don't be the star of my next briefing, because you will be if you do something stupid and we catch you on film. So yeah, but the vast majority of the photographers and the TV crews, they understand and respect what we're trying to do is keep them safe. We're not trying to make life difficult for them. We just want them to understand the rules. That's all it's about.
Jeff, I was going to ask a quick question about, you know, you've been involved in the event for quite a long time now. How has the media interest changed in that period? You know, has it grown, and or has the nature of the sort of media requests that you get, you know, has that evolved over that period too? Because it's such a global event, isn't it? And there's such focus on it. And as you say, there's competitors from all different series actually want to be involved as well. It'd be just interesting to understand how you've seen it change over that period.
I don't think the media interest has changed that much. It's grown, but I don't think it's changed that much. We're getting more lifestyle media now than we did back in the day. It is a very much a French event. It's run as a French event, and all power to it, because it's very, that's what it should be. However, it is a massive international event, and we've moved on since the WC came into fruition in 2012, and Le Mans was part of that. It was part of the championship. We've moved it from, if you like, to push it out a little bit more. And we've taken the ACO with them. You know, the ACO were very, very proactive. And now it's massive. You know, we're talking 1,200, 1,300 media across the world. You know, there is a entry list for the cars. And there's always more cars than can think. And it's also the same for the media. There's never enough space. So they do have to limit the amount of media to attend. But, you know, we get international media from all, you know, all over the world, you know, print, TV and internet.
So, I mean, you look at a race, the fans turn up for the race. They always look at the media and think we're spoiled and we've got all the best places. As a photographer, how would you recommend somebody get really good pictures without having the media access?
I did a thing. One of my other roles is I was until this year, about the last 8 years, I've been a Fujifilm ex-photographer, which is an ambassador for Fujifilm. One of the things we did in 2016, we actually launched the X-T2 camera at the Le Mans Classic. So they asked me to write a a guide because we couldn't go meet trackside with the guests. So I went up into the spectator areas and started looking for areas to there. And Le Mans is actually very good. In fact, there are a couple of spaces at the Forest S's. I actually go into the spectator area to shoot rather than shoot trackside because you get a better view and you get a different view. That's the one thing with photography is you're always looking for something different. And a place like Le Mans is being done to death. You know, it's every area has been done, you know, and but you still have to do those shots, but it's nice to find something a little bit different. What we say to the spectators is always look for something different. Don't just concentrate on the cars. Yes, we have high fences, but we also have high banking. So you can get up higher, shoot through the trees, you know, and get those sorts of shots, which, again, you need to be in the spectator areas to get those shots. So, yes, be creative. A media pass is not the be-all and end-all. And it's also very, very dangerous down there, as was proven in 2011 when Alec Manish crashed. Well, he was hit off at the Dunlop curves and he took out six photographers who, if the car had risen 6 inches higher, it would have cleared the barriers and taken out those photographers and ended up in the photographer area. So it's not for the faint-hearted. And this is one of the things I say in my briefing is, be careful, don't block your ears, listen for sounds, but also keep an eye out for what's going on around you because it can be dangerous. So, yeah, but no, spectators, you know, I started as a spectator. That's how I started Donington Park back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, taking pictures over the fence. And that's the way you have to start. We all have to start somewhere.
Has there been any particular drivers that have really impressed you the way that they, you know, they understand the job you do as well as the racing that they do?
I think when we had Mark Webber come across from Formula One, also Fernando Alonso, you know, you get this impression that they're very standoffish because Formula One is such a circus. And I must admit, Mark, when he came over in 2014, he was a bit standoffish for the first couple of races. But the time he got to Le Mans, he was basically, as long as we didn't take the mickey with the amount of stuff we wanted him to do, he was more or less up for everything. With regards to requests, interviews, that sort of thing, TV. And he was being, and same with Fernando, he was also a little bit standoffish to start with. And then he realized we were there to help him, not to hinder him. It goes across all the drivers, but you tend to find the F1 guys who have been there, done that, got the t-shirt, so to speak. And they're just there to do a job. And we try to keep the request to a minimum. I've got Valentino Rossi for my Road to Le Mans race at Le Mans this year. And he's proving a slightly more difficult, but I'm going through it. But I'm going through his people, not through him directly. He might be I've never worked with him, so I don't know. He might be the nicest guy ever. But you've got to go through the rigmarole to get to these people. And it's sometimes the people that are in front of you that are causing the problems, not the driver themselves. So we'll see.
Jeff, just on that note, this is an aside, but Valentino Rossi, when he came to do rallying, when I was involved in the WRC, we found his people really challenging to deal with and thought, oh, this is going to be massively difficult, even when he was just coming to test. And lo and behold, when he turned up himself, would do anything. Lovely guy.
That's good to hear. You know,
really,
that's
nice
good
guy.
To hear.
And really,
that's good to hear.
Really up to for having fun as well. Really up for having fun. But getting to that point wasn't easy. So hopefully that'll prove the case for you too.
I hope so, because I'm looking forward to meeting the guy. He's a legend, you know, and I want to, you know, I've met a couple of legends in my time, and I'll talk about that. But one of my favourite legends a bit later. But yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting the guy and seeing how he does in a LMP3 car. GT3 car.
Yeah, well, we were just talking about him last episode of the Fast Pod because he had a great result down at Brands Hatch the other week. So, you know, it looks like he'll be as quick on four wheels possibly as he was on two. Jeff, I was just going to ask you, in terms of photography, you were talking about different styles of shots and things like that there. But what is the secret of a great shot for you? You know, what when you take, you know, lots and lots of photographs, but what are the ones that you find particularly satisfying?
People shots. I tend to find car shots. I come from a newspaper background. I worked on local newspapers, so I have to tell a story with a picture. And motorsport is one of those sports where the athletes are inside a car, inside a helmet, and you can't see them working. It's very difficult. Unlike I do a lot of rugby as well, so I've shot at Murrayfield a few times, and it's very different. You can see them working, you can see the expressions, you can see the dynamic imagery you can get for this thing. So I prefer to be in the pit lane. I prefer to be in the paddock. I also talk to the fans. You know, you get these super fans, as you know, who get dressed up in their favourite teams thing. That's coming more and more into Le Mans over the years. That's come more and more, especially with Toyota. And we get the super fans who are there every year, and we go and chat to them and get their portraits. And it's the human interest stories that are more for me rather than the action shots on the track. You know, we have to get those action shots, and I love getting a good dynamic, especially if you've got a GT car going around a corner with two wheels up in the air. It looks great, but if it's just a car on a track, yeah, it's great, but it's not telling that story, that whole story. And that for me is a good, that's a good mark of photography. I like arty stuff as well, but not all sponsors like arty stuff. You know, but again, I like my, you know, blurs, lots of blurs and lots of lights and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it's you have to get what when I do my talks, I do a lot of camera club talks, and I say, you have to get the banker shots. You have to get the ones that you have to get in the bag to fulfill your thing. And then you can start being arty. And that's what the ones I prefer to do, the arty stuff.
You talk about super fans there. I remember over in Fuji, I mean, the Japanese fans are just remarkable with the colour and the enthusiasm.
They're bonkers. I love the Japanese. I love it. And Japan's my, after Scotland, Japan is my second favourite place in the world. And I used to go visiting there when I used to go with the WC race at Fuji Speedway. I also went to Suzuka in 2013 because the FIA asked me to go and do an F1 race, and they were in Suzuka the week before we were in Fuji. So I went over, and these guys are dressed up in samurai armour and things like that, you know, and it's not just plastic cheating. It's proper samurai with all the colors of the teams on it, and you think they're just crazy, but they are. They're just crazy good, not being crazy bad. They're crazy good, and it's just an amazing atmosphere in the paddock. And we were getting 50,000 to a WC race at Fuji Speedway, and they love it. And also the way they queue when we do the pit walks, they just queue for everything. It's very Japanese. There's no pushing, there's no trying to jump, they just queue, and they're all in their little rows, and it's great. Absolutely amazing.
So I'd imagine it was a slightly different challenge. I mean, maybe not many people know that you were actually involved at Rockingham, so that would be slightly different, I would imagine.
That was very different. That was my second full-time role in motorsport. I was for the first year, which was 2000, I was Jonathan Palmer's press officer for the European Formula Palmer Audi, and also his press officer at Bedford Autodrome. This is before MSV came into fruition. So, and then end of that year, I was asked by Steve Slater at Kingpin Media to go and work with him on the opening of Rockingham. And I was there for 5 years, from 2001 into 2005. And that was a roller coaster, shall I say, heck of a roller coaster. It also taught me a lot about the subject of obviously noise, which so a lot of circuits come under. We had to deal with that issue a lot, and I'll tell you some stories about that in a minute. Also working with the local media, I went down to see, the first thing I did was went go and see the editor of the local paper, which was a sister paper for the one I worked in, Grantham. And I said to him, he said, why have you come to see me? And I said, well, I wanted to introduce myself and also want you to be, you know, what do you need from us? And he actually said at that point, nobody from the circuit had actually spoken to him. And I thought, well, you're covering us 365 days a year. We'll have our Champ Car race in September, which we'll have all the international media covering, coming to us. But you're going to be covering us for the entire year. So I need to set up this sort of relationships. And it worked very well. I didn't expect him to give us a free ride. But also, if you have that relationship, you've got the right of reply, which is the most important thing when they're covering stories, especially when you're dealing with noise. We had an issue with noise, as you can probably imagine. We had the usual complainers, shall we say. Now, our noise limit was 47 decibels in the local villages, which were about a mile and a half away. Now, 47 decibels is not a great deal. I think it was right, the A45, which ran alongside one of the villages, the background noise was 48 decibels, which is actually louder, but because it was a constant noise, you didn't tend to hear it. Anyway, I was looking for a new inkjet printer, and this inkjet printer said it was a low noise printer. It was an Epson one, I remember. And he said it was a low noise printer and it was 49 decibels. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I printed it off and put it in my back pocket. Anyway, 3 weeks later, we got a noise complaint from the usual suspects, and the paper contacted me. So I said to the journalist, I said, right, if you're in your office in Gretton, in your home in Gretton, you're running a printer and we're running 26 Champ cars around our circuit, which is louder in your house? And he said, oh, the race cars, obviously. I said, nope, there you go. There's a bit of paper that says, no, we're not. And we've always been under our noise limit. So he's trying to explain in layman's terms what noise actually is and how it affects people. So it's quite an interesting experience of those 5 years I spent there dealing with those sorts of issues.
Wider than that, Jeff, though, I mean, Rocky, I had the pleasure of going there, you know, with teams working in touring cars and things like that, and, you know, phenomenal facility. But do you have a feeling as to sort of why it just didn't work, why it didn't stick, you know? Because I think everybody wanted it to, maybe apart from some local residents. But I think in the motorsport community, everybody liked it as a venue. But, you know, it just didn't work for whatever reason. Have you got an inkling as to why that is?
I think there's a few reasons. I think the fact that it was built as an oval and the infield circuit, most drivers would call it Mickey Mouse, and I have to be honest with you, I would probably agree with them. We did change it after the first year to get rid of the, so we could use turn one rather than turn four, because we had the issue with the first year with the launching Formula 3 cars. They ended up on the roll hoops because they were lifting and getting air underneath them. Catherine Legg being very... the very famous Jeff Bloxham picture of Catherine Legg on car on a roll hoop at the first corner. So we managed to get that sorted. We were quite successful with the Days of Thunder, ASCAR/Days of Thunder. The reason we changed it to Days of Thunder was because we were always trying to explain what it was to people, saying it's like NASCAR in the States, and everyone goes, what's NASCAR? Most people, if you're into motorsport, it's fine, but the lame people in the street don't know what NASCAR is. Have you seen the film with Tom Cruise, you know, Days of Thunder? And they go, oh, yeah, that's the type of cars we ran at Rockingham. And then we started putting the big name acts on the stage. We had a big stage, and we were dragging in families. We were getting 40,000 plus, but it wasn't sustainable, because it was costing so much money to put those acts on. The idea was to get a sponsor in. Channel 4 were interested in doing something and the rest of it. And it, for whatever reason, it just didn't happen. And then, it was a shame. We had big name stars, you know, Dario Franchitti coming over to do his Champ Car, winning the Champ Car race in 2002. Obviously Colin McRae, which is the legend I was telling you about, when I had to spend the day with Colin doing his rookie test, because he raced in the ASCAR race in 2002, support race, and he finished sixth from the back of the grid. What a legend. He took me out in a Subaru Impreza around the infield circuit, and that was the best half an hour I've ever spent in a car, with a, you know, absolutely amazing half an hour watching Colin work. I do get some perks in my job, and that was definitely one of them. The other thing we used to do is we used to try and get as many big magazines and TV shows to come and film, or do a big car test, Autocar, Top Gear, etc. We attract them all to come and do it, and obviously they had to say where they were, and it got us, you know, put us on the map, because we were up against Silverstone, Donington, etc., and we were on the back foot a little bit. The good thing was it was brand new, and the facilities, we always to say, we've got clean toilets. And it was always a bit of a smirk, you know, funny. People used to look at it, why are you telling us that? Well, if you're into motorsport, you know exactly what we're talking about. When you go to Donington or Silverstone or whatever, you know, the toilets are not exactly the best back in the early 2000s. They definitely weren't. And I think it raised the game. Everyone else, and then obviously when Jonathan Palmer bought Brands Hatch and Cadwell, he raised the game there as well. So I think it became normal, if you like, to give the spectators decent facilities, which at the end, let's be honest, at the end of the 90s, there weren't decent facilities at most circuits. So, yeah, I think the legacy is that Rockingham showed the way it could go. Why it failed, I don't know. I think it was just a changing hands too many times, you know, people pumping a lot, losing a lot of money on, at the, you know, whether it was the right time to do a new circuit in the UK, who knows?
You're speaking about Colin there and how impressed you were with him. How do you think he would have got on at Le Mans?
I think he was like his hero, Jim Clark. I think he could jump in any car and just drive it fast. I think he was one of those drivers. Watching him I did an interview with him after he did his rookie test, and I said to him, "How did you find it?" And he said, "Well, I tell you something, when I'm enjoying myself, my right knee shakes." And he said, "It hasn't stopped shaking for 60 laps." And I said, "What's it like not having Nicky Grist shout blathering in your ear all the time?" And he said, "Very peaceful." So it was, you know, he was there to enjoy it. He wasn't there to, he's competitive, but he was there to try his hand at an oval, you know, an American style oval race. And he did really well, you know. I also said to him, "What's it like running against the wall, you know, with the concrete wall?" Because obviously it scares a few drivers. He said, "When you've gone through Kilda Forest at 100 miles an hour, walls don't bother. You run along a wall, if you hit a tree, you stop." So, you know, it didn't faze him. It really didn't faze him, where it fazed a lot of other drivers.
I was just going to say, I mean, obviously you've been to a load of different circuits. So which one do you actually like the best?
I love Spa. I think it's a bit of a cliche, but I do love Spa. Fuji Speedway is very good. I like because it's in Japan. I'll be honest with you, I wasn't that impressed with Suzuka. Everyone raves about Suzuka, and I wasn't that impressed with it. But then, you know, I couldn't get around much because it was a Formula One weekend. If I went there for a Super GT weekend, perhaps I'd be able to see the circuit a lot more than I did when I was there. But, Spa, I just love, I absolutely adore the place. You know, I go there. Well, I was going sometimes three times a year, and it's just an amazing circuit, and you can see why the drivers all rave about it. You know, I've never raced, so I don't know what it's like to go through Eau Rouge at, you know, max power and not lift through up the top, but as you go through Radion. But yeah, it's an amazing circuit and very photogenic from a photographer's point of view. There's a lot of choices, very photogenic. The ones I don't like the most, I would hate to say this, is Silverstone. I do not like Silverstone at all. So it's a good driver's track, but from a photographer's point of view, you're so limited where you can go and what sort of shots you can get. It's a bit boring for me as a photographer. Great facilities though. Now they've done since 2010 when they did the wing and the new part of the circuit. Yeah, definitely Spa.
Jeff, you've talked about Colin McRae there and how impressed you were with him, but what other drivers have impressed you over the years, both in terms of, you know, their outright speed when competing, but also out of the car?
I've had the pleasure of working alongside Johnny Herbert. Now, Johnny was always a favourite of mine when he was doing Formula One, you know, a bit of the underdog, the cheeky chappy underdog. And I liked when I met him for the first time out of the car, I was so pleased that he was like his on-screen persona, the cheeky chappy thing. I've worked with him over the, you know, as a commentator, alongside as a pundit over the last few years. I remember he came to Rockingham with Murray Walker to do the Top Gear Awards in 2001. And we were up in my office, which was overlooking the circuit, and it was raining, absolutely chucking it down. So they couldn't do any filming until it stopped raining. So Murray, I was chatting to Murray, as you do with Murray, you're just chatting. He's got all these stories. Some of them you've heard before, but it doesn't matter. It's Murray Walker. And Johnny said to me, can I go on your computer? I need to check my emails. Back in the day before we had smartphones, you know. So he said, yeah, just go and use my computer. Don't worry. Anyway, Andy Wilman calls up to get the guys down because it stopped raining. About 10 minutes later, I get a phone call from my IT manager saying, why have you been on all these porn sites? Because he checked his emails and then went and he knew what was going to happen and he just did. And that's what he's like. He is such a breath of fresh air. On track he's so quick, off track he's just a great great fun to be around. Fernando Alonso, I've come back to him. You know, he did won two Le Mans. Okay, you could argue that the Toyota had no opposition, but you still had to win. You still have to get Le Mans. It's not just about beating all the other cars. It's actually beating the track as well. You still have to get to the end of the track. Talk to Kazuki Nakajima in 2016 when he was leading right up to the end of the last race and until the last lap, and then he stopped on the last lap. You know, he was shoo-in for a win, and they failed. They weren't even classified one lap before the end of a 24-hour race. So it can happen. So, you know, hats off to Fernando. He came in. He didn't act the big I am. He was there to learn, and he learned, and he did a brilliant job. You know, only the second driver to ever win two FIA World Championships and do different disciplines. Petter Solberg being the other one. Jose Maria Lopez is now the third one because he won the WEC and he's also won the WTCC. So we've got a few drivers that have come across, and it's interesting to see how these drivers, these top drivers, come over and see the challenge of endurance racing. I think endurance racing has always been seen a bit of a Formula One retirement home over the years. That is gone. I think that is completely gone. We've got our own young drivers coming through the rankings, if you like, from LMP3, LMP2 up to hypercar now. And we've seen a lot of drivers come through, and they're making their own mark in their own way. And young drivers are seeing endurance racing as a credible alternative to single seaters, which we all know are very expensive, and you don't get paid until you're right at the top of the game. Whereas, you know, tin tops and endurance cars, sports cars, seem to be the way to go these days, because you get paid as a driver, get paid further down the pecking order, if you're good enough. I love working with Jan Magnussen. He's there again this year. He's in an LMP2 car this year. He went into a GT3 car last year. I thought, what's he doing in the Michelin Le Mans Cup? He must be platinum. He's only gold. Jan Magnussen's only rated his gold. But he's now known as Kevin's dad now. He's Kevin's dad, not Jan Magnussen. He's Kevin's dad. So, but no, that's a bit unfair to Jan, because he's always been quick, always been quick. But again, he's enjoying himself. He's enjoying himself in GT3s, and he'll be in Le Mans in an MP2 car.
I think driver ratings would take us a whole new podcast. Very, very a short answer, if you might. How do you think Le Mans will go this year?
I think it's going to be very interesting because of all the hypercars. It's going to because they've got rid of the LMGT Pro and Ferrari and Cadillac, and you've got all these brilliant names. Okay, it's the first proper season. I would say the first proper season of hypercar, and obviously Toyota have got a massive advantage because they've been doing it for so long. But I don't know. I feel that, you know, I think Ferrari could come good. Those cars look amazing. You know, when we launched hypercar back in 2019, it was muted, and you saw the line drawings of these cars, and you just think, yeah, this is where Le Mans should be. You know, it's the evocative names on cars you can't buy on the street, but they look like the cars you can buy to go on the street. And I think it's, yeah, that Ferrari and the Peugeot. Okay, Peugeot got a few problems, but the car itself looks just amazing, you know, and they'll get there. It's Peugeot. But they're used to winning Le Mans, not being down the back. So they'll be there. So I think it's going to be interesting. If I was going to bet him, I'd put Toyota, but which one, I don't know. I think Toyota will be there, but I would like to see an upset. I'll be honest with you. I'd love to see an upset. I'd love to see a Ferrari win overall.
Well, as long as it goes all right for you, thanks very much for talking to us, and hope you have a good Le Mans.
No, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to it. And
well, he's absolutely right. Le Mans is going to be a cracker this year, and it would be so good to see Ferrari back on the top step.
Yeah, I mean, that would be pretty evocative, isn't it? And let's be honest, they're coming back in to do that. You know, Ferrari don't want to be also ran, so they're not going to hang around if they're not right at the sharp end. So it'll be interesting to see, though, how close they can get. You know, Toyota are in the groove. You know, they've had the advantage of being in there for seasons and they know it inside out. So I don't know, it won't be easy to topple them, will it?
I'm not sure I've ever been to a Le Mans where there's not a really big twist somewhere. You talk about the media centre. So many people think we get a good deal because we've got this access. But it was so interesting to hear that he talks about going to other places to get the pictures. Biggest irony of them all, that a photographer like that likes to take pictures of people rather than cars.
Yeah, I understand that, and having been on the inside on the media operations, the pictures I always like putting out were the emotional ones. You know, if a snapper managed to get a driver who just stepped out of the car and he was either elated or actually sometimes dejected, because that told a better story than, you know, just seeing the car popping back into the pits, because it's been on camera, you know, for the whole race, etc. So, yeah, I totally get Jeff's point about, you know, trying to get those people stories out. What I thought was fascinating is just that insight Jeff gave into the scale of the media operation at an event like Le Mans. You know, you and I have been to things like this before, and we've been in amongst it trying to get our accreditation and things like that as well. But, you know, it's just staggering. You know, Le Mans in particular, it is one of those ones like Monaco, as we talked about earlier on, that everybody wants to be at, and all the media come out of the woodwork. So trying to manage the scale of that behind the scenes is an extraordinary job. And I can understand why he doesn't get to see much racing over a weekend when he's doing that.
It's a weird one in the media room, because there's some people that do not move for the whole 24 hours.
Yeah.
And then there's other people that see about three laps and look at the timing screens, and then they're off to interview people. It's really weird, the dynamics of how people cover the event.
Yeah. The other thing I really agree with Jeff on, I have to say, is circuits. He talked about his favourite circuits, and it resonated with me because, you know, I was down at Silverstone a couple of weeks ago for an event, and, you know, it's a phenomenal facility. You know, track's great from a driver's perspective, as Jeff said as well, but I just have always had this nagging feeling over the years that it's just boring because it's so flat. You know, it's not three-dimensional enough for me. And that's why I've always preferred tracks like Spa. You know, as Jeff said, I know it's cliched, but it's just different, you know, to see the gradient changes. It just offers something a little bit special. But even on a smaller level, you know, in the UK, you know, I've always preferred Oulton and Brands Hatch because they're like that, you know, compared to some of the other tracks, which just, you know, you can't get a good viewing point somewhere. So, yeah, I have to say I'm with him on his track choices.
I don't think many people would argue with his choice of Spa. You're probably going to get some people go, oh, no, Silverstone, it's got to be the best. But I think that's actually worth doing as a blog for the website. Let's let people tell us what they think.
There's good corners everywhere, isn't there? Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in and listening. I hope you enjoyed the insights that Jeff provided. We'll have another great interview coming up very soon from somebody in a completely different category of motorsport. So don't forget to hit that subscribe button and tune in to the next episode of the Fast Pod. Thank you. Thank you.